So this is a lecture on John Locke and Karl Marx, two individuals separated in history by nearly 200 years and probably extremely antagonistic in terms of politics and so on. There's a specific reason that I've put them together, and I'll try and set that up here first, and then I want to move into Locke, talking about the context of Locke, and then into the theory of property offered in Locke, and then I'll shift over to the critique of private property that's present in Marx. Now, there's something arbitrary a little bit about my putting these two together and putting them together in a lecture, except that they are both so tightly connected to the path that we want to follow in this overall class. Most people would not put these two thinkers together, but they do both talk about property, and they do both talk about the relationship of labor to property, and maybe they're speaking from different sides of a society which is rooted in property. Okay, so most general setup here would be to say, so far in this class, we've been talking about values in the sense of what I might call individual goals, or maybe we could say broadly something like cultural values, right? It's not just me who thinks that, you know, for example, getting respect is something that is of value. It's also other people with whom I'm friends. It's also my family. It's also certain aspects of our culture on the whole, which says one could or should live one's life for the sake of having one's dignity recognized, that is, of being respected. So these are cultural values. In general, so far, all we've talked about in terms of values is the things that we identify as being worth pursuing. And we really want to ask, how do we determine those things? Because they seem to determine the path of our lives. They seem to be quite important with respect to our activity as, you know, I don't know, humans. But now we're starting to shift over to values in another sense. And it's not that we're going to leave the first set behind. Rather, what we're going to attempt to do, and we'll especially do this next week when we look at Marx's theory of ideology, and we'll be concerned about this sort of stuff all the way through at least the ethics portion of the course. There's the cultural values, which we've started talking about, but then there's value in a very distinct sense, and that's value like in terms of money. What is something worth? That is its value, right? My cell phone is worth, I don't know, supposedly $300-$400 or something like that, right? Like that's its value. Now that's real different from saying I value respect. I paid $400 for my phone. We use the same term. In the loosest or in the broadest sense, the term has the same meaning. It's something that we consider to be important, something that we consider a good in some sense, and people are only willing to pay $300-$400 for their phone because they consider it to be a good in one way or the other. Now, they may or they may not be right. There are certain ways in which, okay, it's hard to live without a phone. How am I going to do a job interview if I don't have a phone? How's the possible employer going to capture, get in touch with me? How am I going to talk to my family on the other side of the country without a phone? So this is, you know, the phone is valuable as a means to ends in the sense that we have already been discussing. And that is the reason that people are willing to pay $300-$400. The general picture that I want to be considering here, though, is, and the reason to think about monetary value is that, as we all know from our discussions with one another and in our class, money and the making of money seems to be one of the highest ethical values. People empirically means just on the basis of experience or observation, money is one of the primary things that people are living their life for, right? And we live in a system where the pursuit of money and the endless accumulation of money, capitalism, is the dominant system. So we need to think not only about what it is that we want in our lives and what we should want in our lives, but we need also to think about what is the nature of the situation in which we find ourselves and in which we will have to pursue the values that we say we are valuing. That is, we want not just to say what we should do, but we want to evaluate what we can do and where we're at. So in order to talk about where we're at, we need to talk about value in this other sense. And there's maybe a middle ground between values considered as, you know, goods for life and value in the monetary sense, and maybe that's property. Property seems to be at the very foundation of the society and the economic system in which we live. I think that's sort of indisputable. And this is where Locke fits in. Our legal system is based around property. Capitalism is based around private property. The role of the state with respect to capitalism seems to have everything to do with the maintenance of property and the facilitation of the accumulation of ever greater private property for what is, at least empirically, only a very small minority of the population. This is our system. The capitalist system. And it is in this system that we will have to pursue whatever it is we're going to pursue. And if we want to understand politically and socially how it is that people come to share these values about how important it is to make money, about how one should distinguish oneself as an individual, about how one ought to achieve success or respect as an individual. If you really want to understand how we come to have these commonalities in terms of our personal and ethical valuations, then you need to understand something about the overall social and economic system, which is the circumstance of the distribution of these values that are offered to you as what you ought to do. Okay, so that's the overall picture. Now let's move into Locke. There's a couple of reasons to talk about Locke, and I'll go through them here. First of all, let's take a look. And as usual, by the way, I'm reading over the notes that I just made, which I made by reading through the text that you should have read through too. What is the context? Locke's Second Treatise on Government, which is what this section on property is taken from, was published in 1689 in England. Locke was the child of a small landowner who became somewhat prominent politically and was involved with the Whig faction. He was involved in 1688. Well, okay, in the 1640s and then again in 1688, there was something like civil war in England. So usually the one in the 1640s is referred to as the Civil War. 1688 is referred to as the Glorious Revolution. And what both of these, one key thing, that both of these revolutions or wars accomplished was the liberation, the partial liberation of the bourgeois class, the merchant class, business class, landowning class in particular, from the power of the king. So these are key moments in the development of capitalism internationally and the development of both colonialism and the slave trade. They precede by 100 years the American and the French revolutions, which are often thought of as the key landmark historical moments where the business class, people who had money based on business and trade, became politically empowered. And a previous class, the aristocratic class, which had controlled money and power on the basis of inherited land rights and rights of title. These are the moments at which that new business class comes to be in a position of political power. Now, it doesn't take over. They don't do away with the king in England, but the king is disempowered and this class is empowered. Now, Locke was involved with that revolution. He was involved with the movement for a greater empowerment, basically, of landlords. And the people that he was involved with were big landlords and the representatives of those, the friends, the affiliates of those big landlords. So when he talks about property, I mean, this is something to think about with respect to philosophy in general. when he talks about property, he speaks as if he were simply looking into the matter from a purely disinterested intellectual viewpoint. But he's not disinterested, and he does occupy a certain position within the social political landscape. I think that's really important. Let me take a little step back here for a moment and just say something parenthetically, which is probably important for understanding how I'm laying out this course and what kind of discussions I would like to have. For a long time, I taught philosophy from the inside of the canon. A canon is a list of important texts and figures which comes to form sort of the backbone of an academic discipline. Canons have been the site and the terrain and the object of struggle, especially as programs like ethnic studies and Africana studies, women's studies were developed in the 1960s to the 1980s, because those authors and those texts who have been canonized are largely, in whichever canon you want to talk about, if it's the literary canon or the philosophical canon or the musical canon or whatever it is, largely white males. Right. So, and this doesn't mean that they're the only people who had important philosophical thoughts or wrote important books. It just means that they are the ones who have been said to have done so over and over by generation after generation of professor and scholar. Okay. So for a long time, I taught philosophy from within the canon. I taught it as it was taught to me. We start with the pre-Socratics, those Greek philosophers who came before Socrates. We teach Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and then maybe we move on and we teach some medieval philosophy, especially St. Augustine, who was not a white guy, but most of the rest of them are, St. Thomas Aquinas, and then we move on to Renaissance philosophy, and then we get to the moderns, and we read Locke and Hume and Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz, and then we get to Kant, and Rousseau's in there. This is just a big list of white men. And it's not that prevents them having written intelligent things. I think there's all kinds of good stuff in there, and you know, each philosophy professor has their own favorites, the ones that resonated with them or the ones that we were taught most centrally, depending on who our teachers were. You know, and you can teach inside the canon for your entire life without ever thinking about it. I taught inside the canon for a long time before I started thinking about it. And when I say teach inside the canon, I mean, I just took what was given me, what exists in starting teacher will take an introduction to philosophy textbook. I always like the ones that had primary texts, and we just sort of work our way through there. That book is part of the canon. It represents the canon. It repeats the canon. So we could talk about Locke and Marx just in terms of what they said, and then evaluate their claims and look into whether their reasoning is good, whether their arguments are well supported, whether they ever contradict themselves. And then we can look into the way that the positions of different philosophers affirm or contradict one another. This is teaching inside the canon as I'm describing it right now. And, it's a valid thing as far as it goes. But my dawning awareness has become that it's not valid if you don't step outside of it. So, you know, I remember when I was in graduate school for philosophy, asking some older student or more advanced student, you know, is how do we come to get these philosophers and not other ones, these positions and not other ones? How does it come about that in one era, in one period of time, in one place, or in one system of schools, certain philosophical trends, manners of argument, typical positions, key concerns come to be the ones that are key, or the ones that are accepted, or the ones that are taught, or the ones that are considered to be the most advanced and likely the most right? How does that come about? I remember asking, you know, is there a theory of natural selection for philosophers? You know, what causes these things to become prominent? And they didn't have an answer for me. And then a little bit later, I realized, oh, Marx already gave us that theory. And the theory basically says that, whatever philosophical position becomes dominant will become dominant because it operates as an excuse, a justification, and a legitimization of structures of rule, ownership, exploitation, and government. That is, the philosophies that become dominant are likely going to be the ones that naturalize and normalize and justify the way shit is already set up. Now, when we start thinking that way, we're thinking inside Marx and thus inside the canon, but we've got an indication and a recommendation that in order really to understand philosophy, we have to step outside of the canon and we have to step outside of the philosophical text in order to ask about it as an artifact. So what I'm trying to tell you here is that if you really want to understand where we're going with this course, recognize that I'm making it more complicated than it would be otherwise. Because if you took this course from somebody else, they would only talk about a certain set of canonical figures, and they would ask you to understand their arguments, be able to repeat the arguments, and then at best, you know, critically evaluate the arguments. But they would very likely not ask you to think about the historical context in which these arguments were produced, or the social and economic, gender and racial position from which the writer spoke, or where the writer who is writing is situated with respect to the development of the system that we are now within, the development of global capitalism and global colonialism. Most people would not ask you to think about that. And I'm not faulting them for it because they've been taught not to think about that. They've been taught to think that, well, that's history. That's a different discipline than philosophy. Or that's, you know, Africana studies, or that's something other than just doing philosophy. Well, maybe, but I'm going to do it anyway, because I don't think that we can ethically consider the positions of these white men without also thinking about where did they come from and what use was their logic, what use were their arguments, which always pretend to be just plain rationality, just plain thought, as if there was any such thing as just plain rationality and just plain thought that is not situated, positioned in terms of history, in terms of language, in terms of politics, in terms of class, in terms of larger scale economic and social processes. There is no such thing. Philosophers would like to speak as if from heaven, as if from a point beyond the world, but there exists no such point. So I am asking that we think about the inside of Locke and the inside of Marx, that is what they say, and evaluate that. But we also need to understand them from the outside and realize that what we're really studying in the big picture in this class is not just what philosophers said, but ultimately the structured world in which we now exist, and in which the forces that moved these philosophers to think and speak as they did have transformed and developed and yet still act. Ultimately, what I really want you to think about, and we'll get at this in two different ways with Locke and Marx, is that there are competing perspectives about what is true. There are competing perspectives about what is right. There are competing perspectives about what your rights are. And today we can see those competing perspectives in terms of landowners versus peasantry in England, although Locke doesn't name either of those really. We can see it in the opposition between Europeans and the so-called wild Indians of the Americas, as Locke does name them. And then we can also see an antagonism between the owner, say, of a factory and the workers in the factory. This is what we find in Marx. All of these antagonisms and these differences of interest and therefore differences of evaluation with respect to what is good and what we should do, they still exist today. That's what I'm trying to push you to see, that you're compelled by dominant ideas and by educational institutions and by the canons that they throw at you and by many other things. You are compelled to affirm the dominant society as it exists, and that society is in place and operates so as to enrich the few while impoverishing the many. That's a fact. If you don't buy it, speak with me and I'll try and prove it to you. what I'll offer to you is just basically like, let's look at historically what capitalism produces in terms of the divide between the wealthy and the poor. It's an ever greater divide, and those who are absolutely wealthy are fewer and fewer, while those who are totally impoverished are always greater in number. Anyway, even though that's the case, you are encouraged to believe that this is the only system that works. Capitalism is the only system that works. Real government is based on the protection of property. Property is a natural thing. Private property is somehow affiliated with or even identical with freedom. Maybe free trade is identical with freedom too. You are encouraged to believe all these things. So I want you to see the history of that encouragement. I want to work out the terrain in which that perspective battles with another perspective, because colonialization is still going on. Privatization of land, land takeover, the takeover of commons by private property, which is then recognized by legal institutions and which feeds into an international system of commerce, the ultimate outcome of which is the enrichment of capitalists and the destruction of damn near everything else. That's still going on, and that struggle still exists. And so the point, or the question that I would like earnest thinkers like yourselves ultimately to be asking at the end of this class is, which side am I on? Because you're told that there aren't any sides, that there's just how it is, and that how it is good, and how it is progress. And that's bullshit. That's whitewash. That's falsehood. It's falsehood into which we are indoctrinated. So I want you to see that there are outside. So we're going to talk inside the canon. We're going to talk inside the Locke text and like, what does he say? And inside the Marx text, and what does that white dude say? But then we're also going to be stepping outside of those positions and asking, okay, what were the contexts? What were the situations in which those individuals were involved? And I think they were involved in struggles on almost two opposing sides. Locke, to me, is the voice of property. He's the voice of a land-owning class in England, which was also a class which was involved directly not only in the colonial appropriation of North America, but in the radical augmentation and explosion of the African slave trade. These are, so the 1688 Glorious Revolution, it more deeply entrenched landowners in England. It expanded the powers of enclosure, which means the takeover of lands from the peasants, but it also privatized the slave trade, which until that moment in 1687, the slave trade was overseen and limited and regulated by the English crown. Not to say that it's good or that, like, you know, regulated slavery is okay, but it was smaller in scale because of that regulation and because of the deregulation. And oh, and by the way, I'm giving you the analysis that shows up in Gerald Horn, who's a contemporary writer and professor. The privatization of the slave trade allowed for the radical expansion of the slave trade. So that's the perspective from which Locke is speaking. He's not speaking about slavery. In fact, he very strangely omits to mention it, at least in the portions of text that I've given you. And I'm not super familiar with all of Locke's writing, so maybe he talks about it in ways I don't know. But to me, he is the voice of that perspective. Karl Marx, on the other hand, is, he's not flawless, you know, and I identify some of the problems with Marx in your notes if you check it out. There are many problems with Marx. But he is speaking from the perspective of the dispossessed, of the people who are without property. And he takes a very critical perspective on property because, or as a part of, his taking that particular position. You know, Locke acted together with landowners to achieve more political power for those landowners in England. Marx acted together with workers in order to develop international networks attempting to advance the interests of workers. Here's another way in which our considerations link back to our early thoughts or discussions about what's good. Perhaps what we identify as good and what we should pursue varies depending on our class position. So what's good for ownership, what's good for big landowners, is not the same thing as what is good for those who have to work that land. So it's not just that there's a single fact that we could work out together about what really is good. Perhaps working out what's really good for us also means determining the class positioning that we have, the racial positioning that we have, the gender positioning that we have. What is our attitude towards privatization and employment, et cetera, not in general, but in terms of where we are, where our family is, where our friends are, where our connections are. What is our interest? Not just, you know, what ought education to be for, but how should we use it? How should we change it based on who we are here at Dominguez in the most working class school in the California state system, etc. Maybe we really need to think about our positionality. And that also requires that we diagram and map the social and economic context in which we find ourselves. And that is possible, in my estimation, in large part by thinking about the history that produced it. History is the productive process of the present. Just like my cell phone got assembled in multiple steps across different factories, probably mostly in China, the present has been assembled through multiple steps extending through time. Okay, anyway, let's go back to Locke. This text is written in 1689. It should give you, like, you know, a bit of an introduction into the way that philosophy sounds, right? It's hard to read. It's old. As we move forward in this class, you'll have to deal with less and less old texts. You know, you should wrestle, and if you don't make it through everything and if you don't understand every sentence, that's probably just honesty on your part, because I imagine it would be very few people, especially in such an introductory class, who would get every single sentence. We'll try and work through them in class. But I want you to get his, like, basic gist, and I'm going to work through that now. Now, why is Locke considered an important philosopher? Well, he's a canonical figure, meaning that lots of people reference him, right? So if you want to understand later philosophy in the Western philosophical tradition, a good way to go about making yourself familiar with the manner of speech and the vocabulary and the sets of issues and concerns, and even a certain growing stockpile of basic arguments, you can learn the inside of the canon of Western philosophy by working it through historically. Later figures refer to earlier figures. And so Locke is important in this respect, whether we like him or not, whether we like his positions or not, because later philosophers refer to him. There's that. He's also understood as a key figure for arguments about liberal government. Now, this takes us a little bit out of the framework we're operating in today, because technically our class is broken into an ethical and a political half. We're trying to focus on the ethical now, but there are unbreakable connections between the ethical, which to some extent is kind of like the individual, and the political, which is larger in scale and necessarily social. So Locke's position is that Locke is thought of probably as the primary figure advocating and describing what we call liberal government. And liberal doesn't necessarily mean the opposite of conservative. Actually, it doesn't at all, because our conservatives are in favor of Lockean-style liberal government. So this liberal is a bigger category than the term liberal, which we use to refer to, you know, Democrats and, I don't know, whatever portion of the American population you consider to be liberal. This is a broader term. But the liberal government that Locke is recommending is the government pretty much preferred by capitalism, although capitalism can also operate with fascism. And nowadays, we are in a phase which we will call neoliberalism. It's a sort of expansion and development of liberal government. But the basic ideas of liberal government are even touched on here, although they're not named as such. The idea the idea for liberal government is that the state, and remember, government rests upon the power of the state. If there's no state force, if there's no ability to use violence and force, you're not going to have a government. At least not the government in the sense that we understand it. Governments have armies. they don't all have to have standing armies, but historically they almost all do. Like today, the only country that I know of that doesn't have a standing army is Costa Rica. But they all have police, and they all have prisons, and they all have court systems, and they all have legal systems and legal codes. So this is the government, right? I mean, of course, then there are all kinds of bureaucracies which are put in place in order to administer the laws and to, you know, keep order in the way that that is determined according to, you know, one government or another. The liberal idea of government is that, yeah, there have to be such powers. Those powers do have to have the right to operate on bodies by means of force, but their operations should be limited. And what they should really do is secure the conditions for individual liberty, individual freedom, individual property, especially, and then the functioning of individual industry and business. I tend to think that the real concern of liberal government is about the latter and almost not at all about the former. Individual rights, right? Like the primary rights that are going to be recognized are the rights to property, and not everybody has property, and definitely not everybody has property in on any significant level. You might own a car, you might own your clothes, but very few of us own a business or a factory or whatever, right? So this liberal model of government says that government should secure the conditions in which business can be done. And this means, first and foremost, securing property and the right to property and defending property and therefore having laws against theft and having laws which empower property owners and guarantee property. And if you think about capitalism, there can be no capitalism without laws which defend property, because capital is property. Capital is monetary property, which is augmented ad infinitum. Forever. So capitalism involves starting with a certain amount of monetary value and using that money in order to make more money, piling up that money and then starting over. So if you didn't have laws which said it's legal to have property and property will be defended against theft, if you didn't have those laws and a system that was willing to enforce them, you couldn't have capitalism. So the way I look at it, liberal government a la Locke is largely set up in order to facilitate capitalist business. But, you know, people who were more sympathetic to him would say, no. Liberal government is set up on the basis of the individual. And that is something that we really need to talk about, too. We live in a society which advances the idea of individualism, that we are fundamentally just ourselves. And that if we were to succeed, for example, that would be ourselves succeeding. We're not talking about the elevation of the community. We're not talking about the elevation of whole societies. No. If we talk about the advancement of somebody, we usually mean that somebody and not anyone else. So this view, somebody who is sympathetic to Locke would typically suggest, no. Locke is all about the rights of the individual. And that's why he's so important for people who care about freedom, because individuals have to have rights and government has to be put in place in order to defend those rights. And we are familiar with some of the rights that Locke sort of thought were naturally ours, the right to move freely. The right to work where we want, which is, in my critical opinion, a kind of a mask for the production of wage labor, because it's not really like you can work wherever you want. You have to work at the jobs that are available where you are at the rates that they are offering, right? And you have to do that because you can't live otherwise. This is a Marxist reply to Locke. But anyway, Locke is understood as an early, if not the key proponent of liberal government. And liberal government nominally is about the government staying out of things except to guarantee certain rights and especially to guarantee property. Okay. And the other reason that we want to look at Locke is that in this passage in particular, Locke lists off some varieties of reasoning, which are then used as legal arguments and as rhetorical arguments and as ethical justifications for white settler takeover of North America. He's not like an innocent dude. This is an important thing to me. And though you will be encouraged, if you take more philosophy, you will be encouraged to think about philosophy as nothing but a set of rational arguments, which have to be evaluated in terms of, you know, logic and consistency. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that philosophy, like literature and religious writing and so on, really has to be understood as an aspect of a large-scale social, economic, political power system. You know, Locke is not just thinking things through. Locke is offering a justification which was truly and really deployed in a colonial process, which is hyper-violent, is genocidal. And he really is announcing positions which were in the interests of the landowning class in England of his time, and really contrary to the interests of the peasantry, whose land was systematically taken over by big landowners from the 1500s up through, say, the 1700s or even early 1800s. This is the process of so-called enclosures in Europe, which also involved witch hunts and systematic attacks on women and the systematic lessening of the status of women, making laws that women can't represent themselves in court, that women can't own property. Massive reconstruction of Europe was going on through this period, and that is the development of capitalism within Europe. So Locke is the voice of the owner, if you ask me. Okay, so, but what is it that he has to say? What does he say? What are the fundamental problems and what are the answers? The problems are, okay, where does private property come from? Is private property natural, or how can it be understood? And then are there limits on the accumulation of property? And then a related question, where does value come from, especially monetary value? Where does it come from? And then lastly, what is the justification for the takeover of something that had been held in common, say like the woods of North America, which were held in common, roughly and mostly speaking, by different tribes, and definitely within the tribes. There are exceptions to that, like the development of the Iroquois Confederacy, which was kind of imperial power in the Northeast. But they didn't have a system of private property like the Europeans brought. So what is the basis of this system, and how can this system be justified? So here's the reasoning. Here's Western reasoning about property. And this is reasoning that, on the one hand, will justify the basic systems of land allotment. You know, what happens in the U.S. is that land is just laid out in rectangular plots, right? Like Native American people never broke land up into little plots and said, well, this one's yours and this one's mine and I'm not going to go to yours and you're not going to go to mine. They never said that shit, right? They didn't have that conception of private property was foreign to them. But the Europeans imposed themselves, and they want to argue that property in this sense, an individual parcel of land, you know, like staked out at the corners, goes along with an individual name. I would think, you know, on the large scale, and here I'm thinking a lot about this political scientist named James C. Scott, who we're reading once or twice in this class. I would think that this is a fundamental aspect of state building. You know, you want to have individual names associated with individual things because that's the only sure way that you can generate tax revenues. But it's also the only sure way in which you can track and justify the accumulation of large amounts of power over large amounts of territory by large landowners. Okay, so anyway, where does property actually come from, individual property or private property? It comes from labor. That's the answer. Now, here's Locke's reasoning in detail. And I'll tell you to begin with, and then I'll explain after I lay it out, that I think he's cheating. Philosophers cheat all the time. They always want to say that it's just a law of reason, what they're saying. Locke says that, right? He's like, this law of reason, which shows that property is, you know, naturally comes from labor. But I think actually he's involved in a certain secret variety of circularity, which is logically inadmissible. If you assume the thing that you're supposed to prove, you haven't really proven anything. I think that's what he's up to. Anyway, here's how the reasoning goes. He says, okay, my first property is my own body. Now, there's a, you know, a liberal rights framework in which I'm sure that we would all have to agree to this, right? I have to keep my hands off you because your body is not mine, right? And anybody who molests anybody else violates that. Anybody who assaults anybody else violates that. That's a fundamental right, right? Your body is your own. My body is my own. Now, secondly, if your body is your own and my body is my own, then what those bodies, what our bodies can do, what my body can do is mine too. My labor. So I have a certain capacity. And really, if you got into this, it's not just my body, it's my mind too, right? Like I have the capacity to do certain things. According to this, my labor is my own. Now, I start to get really suspicious here because we're talking about labor as something that is owned already. And that, to me, sort of naturalizes in an inauthentic or cheating way the sale of my labor as a commodity on the labor market, which is what we all do insofar as we go and get a job and get paid for it, right? We say to our employer, here's me, here's my labor that I own, I'm going to sell it to you if you give me back some money, because I need money in order to live and to get whatever is the things that I want to get. So I think there's something sneaky in calling my labor originally my property. Anyway, I'll come back to like cutting that up. The claim, though, is that because my labor is my own, now when I go to nature, so think of like the pioneer, who goes, and of course the pioneer is in a violent relationship with the indigenous people who lived wherever the pioneer is operating. But the pioneer shows up and he starts cutting down the trees and he uses those trees to build his cabin. And then he's going to use the cleared land. Maybe he's got, you know, his horse or his oxen, and he's going to try and pull out the stumps and he's going to try and make fields. And he's going to grow stuff on these fields. Now, that pioneer is going to say, this is my land. This is not Shawnee land. This is not Iroquois land. It's mine. And why is it mine? Locke gives the answer. It's mine because I worked on it. It's mine because the form that it has now taken, which has a greater value than previously, supposedly, right? A greater value because now I can raise cash crops on it and I can sell those cash crops on the market. The land has become productive from the perspective of the international capitalist market. Because I have worked on it, it is mine. How does that work? Because I took something that was mine already, my labor, and I mixed it with this land. I mixed it with these trees. I mixed it with this wood, right? Maybe I even made myself like a frame house. And that means that, like, you know, I went down the road to this other frontiers, whatever, business person. And we took the trees that I cut from my land and we ran them through a mill and we turned them into planks. And then we assembled these planks through our own sweat. And now this house is mine because I worked on it. Just like the wood was mine because I cut it down. Just like the land was mine because I started working on it. This is the logic. Now, notice that there are assumptions. There are always assumptions built into arguments. And a philosophical mind, a truly philosophical mind, in my opinion, is a rebellious mind. And it always says, wait a minute. Let me see if we can detect the assumptions in here. What are we taking for granted? So if we go back to this idea that my body and my labor are my first property, notice what assumptions are there. First of all, there is an assumption that there is a difference between me and my body. Me and what my body does. So who's me if me is not my body? Maybe it's my soul, right? So we have the kind of mind-body dualism typical of the Western philosophical tradition. But then we've also got the positing of a certain relationship between me and my body, which is already a relationship of property. So Locke is nominally attempting to identify the basis of private property, but in reality, he's starting off by assuming that property already exists. A relationship of one thing owning another already exists in the relationship between me and my body and in the relationship between me and my labor. Now, where's that come from? You can tell from his own text, it's related to the biblical Protestant Christian tradition. And the Christian tradition on the whole, which includes Catholicism, because we're here, about 150 years after the Protestant Reformation, and Locke is coming out of a basically Puritan household, and he cites the Bible a bunch. And what is it about the Bible? Well, supposedly in the Bible, God says to humans, and specifically to men, hey, all this around you, it's all yours, and it's yours to develop, and it's yours to improve through your work. So Locke is assuming the relationship of propriety, of property, and he's doing it really on the basis of a religious tradition. Okay. Anyway, let's ask another question, which he also asks. What about limits on property? If property naturally emerges from what we work on, such that whatever we work on, we own. And you might be already thinking ahead to Marx, but be like, that actually has some radical consequences, right? Doesn't that mean that the people who actually do the work on a ranch own the ranch and not the fancy pants dude with the nice cowboy boots who drives his truck around but never gets his hands dirty? You know, like you can get a real Marxist radical perspective out of this. Locke doesn't want to, but you can. Anyway, to begin with, he gives two different answers, and they are contradictory to one another, and it makes me think that the first one is in bad faith, honestly, or that the second one he's not really thinking through, which is possible too. Are there limits on property? Yes, there are. That's answer number one. There are limits on property. I can go out and collect as much fruit as I want from trees that are held in common. That is, nobody owns them. And each one of those, let's say, citrus, all those oranges that I take from those trees, the moment I take them, because I did the reaching, I'm putting labor into this object, they're mine. But if I collect so many oranges that I then put them in a pile in my backyard, and I'm eating some of them, but eventually they all start to rot, and they just deteriorate, and they mold, and they get eaten up by animals and bugs, I wasted all of those oranges. Everything I didn't use, I wasted. And Locke's like, that's exactly the limit of property right there. If you take more than you can use, you are exceeding the natural bounds of property. And it's the spoiling of these goods, these commodities, well, they're not commodities yet, of these goods. A commodity is something that is sold on the market for a profit. These goods, the spoiling of these goods shows that I exceeded my right to property. And anybody else would have had, would have been justified in taking that excess away from me because I wasn't using it. That's answer number one. And that to me seems like very moderate. Like, yeah, sure. Shouldn't people have a right to whatever they can use? And you can get all kinds of socialist positions out of that, by the way. But then he gives a second answer, and it's based on a certain economic historical reality, which is that, well, money gets around this problem. When people start using money, they start using gold as a means for exchange, such that I can take my oranges and I'll trade them to you and you can give me money and then you can eat the oranges, or you can take them and sell them and get some more money. It might well be that all those oranges that I picked, which so exceeded my capacity for use, end up getting consumed by different people, and therefore they don't spoil. And the money that I have received, the whole merit of that, the reason that one substance as opposed to another is chosen as money, is that it has to be both scarce, so gold or diamonds or silver, it's scarce commodities, scarce objects, materials that end up being used as money, or seashells. A lot of cultures used shells as money because they're imperishable. Scarce and imperishable. But that's the thing. The money can't spoil. And because the money can't spoil, we just got around the problem with the limitation of property. So if I turn whatever goods I have into money through exchange, now all of a sudden there's no limit to how much money I can acquire, because money is not going to deteriorate. So he starts off by moderately asserting that there have to be limits on property, but he ends up by saying, well, no, not really. There are no limits on property. And maybe he sort of dabbles with the idea that if my possession of a tremendous amount of money, or especially a tremendous amount of land, which is what he's primarily thinking about, if that impedes the well-being of other people, if it makes things worse for them, then maybe I have exceeded the rational, so-called rational bounds of property. But I don't think he's really thinking that through, because in my opinion, and in Marx's opinion, any significant wealth produces a power differential between people, and it facilitates the exploitation of the poorer ones by the richer ones. So any significant degree of wealth, not necessarily any individual property, but arguably anything that's private property on the Marxist definition, which means the kind of property that puts a person in power over another person. So if I like own a house that I rent to other people, I'm in a position of power over them. And when they pay me rent, it builds equity for me, but not for them. So I use their position of dependency in order to increase my position of power over. Right? It doesn't seem like in a capitalist society the accumulation of money is neutral. It empowers a minority and it disempowers a majority. Okay. Anyway, and then two more things. Here's something that's really important for Marx, and then I've already been indicating the way in which this can be sort of inverted or like turned against Locke's angle. This is the labor theory of value. So he's asking the question and giving an answer in exactly the same way that Marx will. The question, where does monetary value come from? How is it that certain objects, certain things in the world are worth more than others? And the answer that he gives is that the things that are worth more are worth more because more labor has been invested in them in order to produce them. Now, you might think like, well, wait, in my economics course, I was taught that value comes from scarcity. Marx is not, and Locke either, I don't think either of them is ignorant of the fact that it is often scarce things that are of high value, but they can just translate this back into the labor theory of value and say, well, yeah, a scarce thing requires a lot of labor. It takes a lot of time to find it. If gold is so valuable, the fact that it's so hard to find gold and so hard to extract gold is the reason for it. So its scarcity corresponds to a high amount of labor that is necessary to get it to wherever it's going to go. And there's already a kind of proto-Marxist understanding in Locke that commodities that have monetary value, their value corresponds to the amount of labor that's put into them. And if you really look into their backgrounds, there will be not just one instance, but a whole series of instances of the investing of labor into this particular commodity. So in the notes, I went through the whole thing with like the cell phone, right? But this, it'll work for anything. Look around you. Everything around you is the result of human labor. By the way, even if you're looking out the window at the trees, these trees are not just naturally here. They've been planted by people. We don't live in some like untouched nature. Everything around us is the result of human labor. And if you look into any given thing, so like right now I'm looking at this like synthesizer that I have that I play that's sitting on, you know, sitting 6 feet away from me right now. Like that thing was assembled. This one was assembled in a factory in Asheville, North Carolina, because it's a Moog. But then the components, which is supposed to be good, right, because it's like American made. But then the components were made somewhere else, right? And then and those components, so like what would the components be? There's a power supply, and there's a set of oscillators. And, okay, those things were assembled somewhere else. At least some of them were. The wire that was used was put together somewhere else, and it was put together from, you know, raw metal. And where did that metal come from? Well, really, it's alloys, and so that required a previous labor process. But then ultimately, this stuff originated in some extractive industry, which was labor intensive. So everything that has value because through multiple stages, labor has been folded into it. And when we get to Marx, more specifically, labor has given a new form to these materials. Okay. So let me just start saying then how this labor theory of value produces a position or can produce a position which is antagonistic in principle to Locke's. And that is that if it is labor that gives value to things, wouldn't – oh, wait, let's back up. If it's labor that produces property, if whatever I work on, insofar as I invest my labor in it, it's mine, doesn't this mean that the slaves who produced cotton in the South owned the cotton in principle, in true right? They owned the cotton. It was theirs. They picked it. It's theirs. It's their labor, which is in that cotton, which, like, you know, was able to separate that cotton from the plant with all kinds of bleeding fingers and sore backs, not to mention the whip. That's their cotton, right? And so when the plantation owner takes the cotton and sells it to the person who runs the textile factory up in New England, and there was this systematic connection, by the way, in the history of the United States between the slaves, the slave plantations, and the North, where they like to pretend they were above slavery and more moral than Southerners. Anyway, wouldn't it mean that that slave owner who took the cotton from the hands and the bags of the slaves was robbing them? Doesn't the owner rob the worker? This is Marx's position. This is what Marx is going to say. Yes, indeed, it is true. The slave owner robs the cotton from the slave. The factory owner robs the textile from the worker in the factory. It's the worker whose labor is involved in those objects. And therefore, if there is any natural relationship of property, that object is the worker's. Okay, so this is how we're going to move from Locke into Marx. And I'll apologize that, like, I've made this such a long lecture. I probably should have made it two, but I'm already started. So let's go on to Marx. Now, Marx is in a radically different context. He's writing in this text is written in as an early Marx text, and he never published it. But people got really into it in the 1950s and 60s when it finally was published. He's writing 1848. And he's writing from a radically different perspective than Locke, as I already described. He identifies with the position of workers and with the position of the impoverished majority who live under capitalism and whose labor it is that goes into the production of the commodities, the sale of which produces profit for the owners, but not for the workers. Now, next week, when we read sections of Capital, we'll get a real clear, direct analysis of how capitalism works and how it continually produces a greater and greater distance between the owners and the workers, such that the harder the workers work, the weaker they become with respect to the boss. Because as they work, they get paid, but they only get paid what it costs them to live. Meanwhile, they are made to work long enough that their labor produces more value than what they cost. That difference between how much they get paid and what they produce in terms of value, that is ultimately profit. That's what the owner takes. That's what augments capital. That's surplus value. That's what makes capitalism go. That is the very heart of capitalism, the accumulation of value through business enterprises, and then the reinvestment of that money in further business enterprises further to develop that capital. So the capitalist is always getting richer if they're a good business person. Otherwise, they're going to fall out of business eventually, and maybe if worse comes to worse, they're going to have to take a waged job, in which case they will be exploited. Meanwhile, the workers are stuck in a situation where they are always the same amount of poor. Yeah, you get your paycheck at the end of the month, but then you have to pay off all the other capitalists from whom you get food and housing and clothing. And at the end of the day, having taken care of your kids and the rest of your family, you're dead broke, and you better not leave that lose that job through insubordination or whatever else, because if you do, you won't be able to live. So this is proletarianization. The workers get stuck in a condition of want. And this also, historically, this required taking away their capacity to produce goods for themselves. So the enclosures of land in England and in the rest of Europe had the effect of pushing peasants off the land that they had previously used. So sources of water that they used to have, sources of meat by hunting in the woods, sources of firewood and of building materials from the shared woods, land on which to graze livestock, which they could then slaughter and eat, or which they could, you know, milk and make cheese from. You know, all these capacities to live, which the peasantry used to have, had to be done away with in order to produce that peasantry as a proletariat, as a body of individuals who are so needy that they will go work in a factory for whatever wage the owner wants to give them, and specifically for just that wage, which will always be less than the money to be gained by the sale of the product that the workers have made upon the market. Okay, this is Marxist theory, right? But the reason to put these two texts together is that Marx also is asking, what is the origin of private property? Now, he doesn't necessarily mean individual property in the super simple sense like Locke does, because the simplest answer to that question in Locke is like, well, the person reached up to the tree and pulled down the orange. Now it's theirs. They did the appropriative gesture, that is the making property gesture, which removes the orange from the state of nature where it's common to anybody and anybody can take it. And there's no wrongness about that. Now that it's in their hand, it's theirs. Well, Marx is thinking more about private property on the bigger scale, specifically private property, the kind of private property that a business person has, where they produce, supposedly they produce, they own a factory which produces, or where laborers produce, commodities which are owned by the owner, and which are sold on the market, and which, if everything goes well for the owner, return a profit. How does that get set up? And Marx's answer basically is that private property is based on theft. And he's sort of just taken this from an earlier French writer named Proudhon, who had said, all property, and he meant bigger private property, that's any property that puts me in a position of power over another person, all private property is theft, or in brief, property is theft. This is what Marx is describing. He talks about it in terms of alienated working conditions. But if you think about, you know, this relationship where individuals work on the material world, and in working on the material world, according to Locke, they make things that are theirs. I make nature, I make raw materials mine by working on them. I get some wood from out in the woods, but then I work it over, and now it's like it's a desk that I can use. Of course, I skipped over the milling and all that. But say, like, we work on this material, now it's ours because we put our labor into it. Marx is still thinking there is something natural about that. Marx thinks that there's something natural and human and harmonious about individual humans who have the capacity to act upon the world. We have hands, we have minds, we have time, we have energy. We like to work. We like to change things. And I think this early Marx, he really thinks of humans as fundamentally like creative and almost like artistic beings. That's like the natural situation which capitalism fucks up. It's a situation where I work on the world around me and then I remain in community with it. Like, so the furniture that I make is around me. The house that I build is around me. Yes, my labor has been objectified, to use Marx's language, in these objects, but they haven't been taken away from me. So humans ought to live in a sort of like symbiotic and metabolic ongoing relationship of harmony and mutual transformation with the physical world around them. Or maybe, you know, he wouldn't say like mutual transformation and harmony. Marx is still motivated by the Judeo-Christian tradition and the relationship it hypothesizes between humans and the rest of the world. That is, Marx, even though he's an atheist and he thinks that religion is a form of delusion used to manipulate people, he still thinks that humans have been given the whole world for their own purposes. But anyway, he's interested in a situation. He idealizes a situation in which we work on things and then they are ours. And we might barter them. We might share them, you know, like trade them with our neighbor for something else that we need. And that's legit. And that's not alienation. Alienation is a forcible separation between what should rightly be mine or what should rightly be in perpetual connection with me, namely the immediate physical world around me and the things that I can make. Alienation is a forcible separation between those things. Okay, now he gives us a list of types of alienation, and what he's basically saying is that capitalist production, which is how we're all caused to work when there's a boss that pays us a wage and which boss or which owner collects the profit. You know, so we get a wage, but they get the profit. So they're always getting richer while we're all staying the same. This system, and that's private property, right? Like, so the business owner owns the business. The business owner owns the products. The business owner owns the profit. These are the kinds of private property that Marx wants to criticize. He wants to say that that relationship which the owner has to his money, to his factory, to his commodities, is rooted in the fundamental alienation and therefore the dehumanization of the workers, even though this alienation is hidden. Now, you know, in our class, this matters because we want to understand the system that we're a part of. We want to understand the values which we are given, like values of private property, and we want to understand the circumstances that we will have to operate in, right? So what Marx is saying is that there are certain things that ought to be valued, the connection between us and our immediate world. These values are destroyed, these cultural values are destroyed by a system which values money and capital accumulation for the few above all else, and then which legally enshrines that and empowers the police and the courts and the prisons to defend those who achieve private property in this respect. Capitalism is exploitative and it ought to be destroyed. This is Marx's position. So he says, okay, there are several forms of alienation which are fundamental to private property in the capitalist sense. There's alienation of the object. So imagine an assembly line, or imagine a small wood shop, but where you do have a few employees who are paid by the boss, and the boss is keeping all the profits, right? So what happens in such a circumstance? The boss, let's say it's the boss and the owner are the same person, which we know is like rarely the case, but for simplicity's sake, the boss owns the shop or pays rent on it. Which puts him in a relationship of exploitation with the landlord, by the way. The boss buys, the owner buys the raw materials, buys the tools. And by the way, they'll always say, hey, this is why, like, you know, we're doing a service to you because you're going to get paid, you're going to be able to live, but we're putting in all this effort to find the place, buy the equipment. We're like charitable people. And Marx is always sneering at that view that the owners have about themselves. And I think he's justified because it's not like any business person ever does that in order to employ their employees. They don't do it for that purpose. They do it in order to generate a profit. And in this system, if they don't generate a profit, they're going to get pushed out of business anyway. So they buy these things and then they buy the labor. If you want to be real specific, they buy the labor on credit. That is, we lend our labor very nicely to our bosses. And they use our bodies and our activities through time in order to generate value that will enrich them. And only at the end of the week or 2 weeks or month do we get paid for the labor that we already advanced them. And then we're going to do it again and again and again. Okay, in that workshop, real hands using real tools in a really intelligent way shape materials into real objects which have a real use. Next week, we'll see that this is use value for Marx. This is production of value. And so it's like Locke says, labor goes together with material in order to produce something that has a value, right? It's more valuable because it's more useful, and it's been made more useful by the deployment of labor. But then, at the end of the day, if one of these workers were to say, like, you know, I actually need a new chair at home. I'm just going to take this with me. We made it, so it's ours, right? And the boss is going to be like, no, I don't think so. If you take that, I'm going to call the cops because it's mine. Even though you worked on it, it belongs to the boss. even though the workers on the assembly line work on the Toyota, it belongs to Toyota. So there's a fundamental alienation of the object. And here we can see Marx using like Locke's logic against the kind of position that Locke had. Locke wanted to speak for the landowners. Marx wants to speak for the workers. They're both saying, yes, value comes from labor, but Marx is saying, and therefore, if the valuable thing is taken away from the person who actually labored, that's theft. Capitalism is rooted in theft. The theft of the things that we actually make at work and the sale of them for a sum that exceeds what we are ever given. The value that we produce goes into the pocket of the boss. Alienation of activity. So while I'm doing this stuff, and the workshop, you know, the carpentry shop is not the best example to me because I like carpentry shops a lot. I always like shops and artist studios. They seem like nice places to me. But you know, the examples I like are like customer service or something. So if you are, you know, somebody who you're a Walmart associate, right? They don't call them employees. They call them associates because they like to lie and try and deceive people. The Walmart associate, what they're doing while they're at Walmart, which they do clearly because they need money and they can't live without it, they are proletarianized. While they're at Walmart, when they're out in the public portion of the store and say a customer approaches them, they cannot just act as they feel and be like, yeah, man, this is a shit job. They pay us shit. Like, what do you want? They can't expect a customer to be, you know, attentive to them. No, the associate will only keep their job if they smile and behave exactly as they have been trained to behave. My point is that it's not just what people make at work that is taken from them, that is alienated from them. It is their own activity while they're at work, which is alienated from them. Capitalism and the production, the perpetual production and reproduction of private property is based upon the dehumanization of people in these many ways. And now we're talking about, like, well, what's a human? You know, on Marx's materialist sort of view, there's no such thing as a soul. I am just my body, my brain, my attention, my processes, the processes that are bodily and physical with me here. And that's what's deployed in the course of my stocking the shelves at Walmart. It's my, you know, my intelligence, my attention. I got to pay attention to what all the labels say and which, you know, which product goes on which shelf and which one needs a new demo put out because it got scratched. And I got to think it through. It might be boring to think it through. And that when I say something is boring, that means I'm alienated from my activity. Oh, wait, we can criticize school along these lines too, right? I mean, when you make a paper for school, do you give a shit about it? Probably not. It's alienated from you. When you study, do you feel empowered and enriched and enlivened and like you're being made better? Probably not most of the time. If this shit is boring and you don't even care, you are alienated from your activity. Maybe education is just preparing you to be an associate at Walmart, metaphorically. Let's see. And then separation from other people. You know, when I'm at work, I can't really, like, you know, I'll do it, but I'm cheating. And I have all kinds of respect for the people who cheat at work. I'll go and I'll, you know, like, chat with my friends at work, but I'm not supposed to, right? I'm supposed to be separate from them. I'm supposed to just do what the boss says. Meanwhile, the person who was working with us and now she's a manager, which means she's getting paid, what, like $2 more? All of a sudden, now our relationship is busted because she thinks that her interest is more lined up with management, and I know that my interest is still different from it. I'd like to get paid more. Management doesn't want to pay me more. This is a fundamental thing we got to recognize, by the way. The interests, what is good for different people in the society is different. And it's not just different individually. I'm not talking like total relativism here. There are class divides. All workers want to get paid more. All bosses want to pay less. All workers would dig having healthcare. All bosses, from a business perspective, have to try to avoid stuff like that, right? There are different interests based on class structuration. This is important. Okay, and let's see. So there's separation in hierarchies, right? And there's a fundamental separation between the working class and the owning class because their interests are really different. So capitalism rests upon an alienation of people from one another. And in the background, Marx is asserting, along with people like Aristotle, that humans are fundamentally social, and we should fundamentally be connected to other people. And in any instance where there's like a systematic institutional divide between us, that's also a form of dehumanization. And then we could talk about alienation of species being, which is like the hardest and trickiest thing. And the reason that he talks like this, and it doesn't make it's really hard to make sense out of, is that Marx at this point is still like profoundly under the influence of Hegel, German philosopher writing early 1800s, who became sort of the dominant force in European philosophy, although not in English and American philosophy. He's using all these Hegelian terms, which is part of the reason he's hard to follow. And so if you really want to get into philosophy, you want to figure that shit out, then you go read Hegel, right? And if you can't read Hegel, then you go back to Kant, because Hegel's super influenced by Kant. Eventually, you can figure out the terms and the problems and why people write like they do. But anyway, species being is like, you know, the relationship of individuals to the entire species. And you can read this in a few ways, I'll read it in maybe just one, because I don't think it matters that much. But Marx is saying that there's something fundamentally perverse and fundamentally dehumanizing and inhuman about the capitalist system. And one of the ways in which that's true, and here's one of the ways in which he explains what alienation from species being is that it ought to be the case that individual endeavor takes place in order to build and sustain the species. We are people, we are animals, although we are special animals, whose being has to do with the entirety of the species. And yet, in a capitalist system, the being of the species, the large masses of people, the almost the entirety of the population, all of their activity through time takes place for the good of a few individuals. So instead of the individual acting for the sake of the whole is caused to act for the sake of the individual. So there are various ways in which Marx thinks that capitalism rests upon a fundamental dehumanization of people, and private property rests upon a fundamental dehumanization of people, separation of people from themselves, from their work, from the world, and from one another, and from their nature. That's the root of private property. And this explains why Marx thinks that any truly progressive social movement has to overcome private property. It has to abolish private property. And we need to move back to a situation where things are held in common.